Celebrating female role models across our community, live from McRobertson Girls High School in Melbourne, Australia, you're listening to Be Like Her Live on McRob Live.
Welcome everyone. Live from the McRobertson Girls High School in Melbourne, Australia, you're listening to Be Like Her Live on McRob Live. My name is Pia and I will be your host, and today my co-hosts are Amna and Shreya. Our special guest today is member of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, Mary Sheargold. Mary Sheargold is a Melbourne-based lawyer and flautist and an alumni of McRob who graduated in 1999. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you.
Now, our first question for you is, did you have any memorable experiences at McRob, particularly about your involvement in school activities such as debating and house events?
Absolutely. So many memorable events at McRob. I was one of the people who went on the first international music tour in 1999. So that definitely very memorable experience that was. But also just the general day-to-day activities we did, you know, inter-school debating, that was an awesome experience to get to have at McRob that we didn't necessarily have at a lot of other schools back then. In fact, it was only relatively new at McRob when I came here. They'd only been running debating for about 5 or 6 years. And so it was, you know, always a special treat to get to go off to Melbourne High on a Monday night, spy on boys and, you know, debate against other schools and meet other erudite and like-minded students. You know, it was very, very interesting. And doing all the musical productions that we did here, working with the boys as well, you know, definitely so many memories.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah, so you talked about, like, because debating was quite recent when
it was.
You joined, right? So, but you became the debating captain.
I did.
Yeah, so how was that?
Captains became a thing when I was here too. So there was no – so when I was in year 10 was the first year we had a school captain.
Oh,
here.
Wow.
So there was this SRC president ran the show before that, and so we brought in school captains and then debating, music and sport captains when I was in year 10. And yeah, I just loved debating, and I, you know, always just thought I was outspoken person, I guess. And so yeah, it was a natural thing for me to want to go towards being the debating captain when I came around to being in year 12. I really admire the girls who did that job before me. Yeah, and it was a wonderful experience. Yeah.
Yeah, so after McRob, you went to University of Melbourne and you were actually the first to graduate with a combined Bachelor of Music and Bachelor of Law degree program. How did your passion for law and music develop during your undergraduate studies, and, you know, how did it shape your career path?
Very well. Did it shape my career path? I'm not so sure, but the passion I have for both of them was always there, right? So when I came to McRob again, I'd come from pretty humble beginnings and the access to music, you know, advancement wasn't really there. So I had been accepted into VCAS, the College of the Arts Secondary School, for year 7. My parents said, no, you're not going there. You know, they don't do enough schoolwork. You're going to go to, you know, normal school, and then, you know, we'll push you off to McRob later, which they did. And so I always had the passion for the music, and I'd always been interested in being a lawyer. So when I was about 9 years old, I remember saying to my parents, I'm going to be a barrister when I grow up. And they said, that's nice, dear. And then, you know, you walk into year 9 at McRob with everybody wanting to be a barrister and a doctor and everything. And it was very, yeah, a very big experience. But for me then too, music and law wasn't a double degree offered at Melbourne University. And I didn't know whether I would have any chance of getting marks to get into law. And honestly, I didn't. I got in the middle band selection criteria, not on my raw VCE marks. But, and the music was just an audition, right? So I was at a level with music where I'm pretty confident that I would pass that audition. And then so all I had to do was apply for my music course through VTAC, or whatever it's called now. It's not VTAC anymore, is it? And then for the law, I had to make a direct application to the law school. Mm-hmm. And then they offered me places for both of them. And then I went to the music faculty and said, okay, great, I'm going to do law as well. And they said, no, you're not. You're going to do music for a year first. We do not allow music students to study part-time in first year. So I had to separate from my friends. Almost all my school friends were doing law at Melbourne. And my, because I didn't have a lot of McRob friends doing music. The one close friend I did have had taken a gap year. So I was sort of on my own there in the music faculty at the start. But it was really interesting and a very, very challenging thing to do. So to, you know, high level music performance, you're practicing probably 30 hours a week. Studying law requires probably about that much reading too. And I think it's fair to say I didn't do so much on the law side as all the practices I did on the music side. But it set me up to, by the time I finished university, my aim was, I think, to become an arts administrator. I thought that way I can use the law skills and the music skills. And I still remember very clearly being at an event. It wasn't a Melbourne High boy, but a boy that I'd known from school who said to me, once you get out to work, you'll never go back and study music. I said, no, I'll just work. I'll work part-time. I'll work for a couple of years, save up the money to move to, you know, I'll move to England and I'll go and have flute lessons there, and I'll be, that's what I'm going to do with my life. And he said, you'll get used to it. And he was right. I did. I never left the law, and I never left Australia permanently.
Wow. Going back on the whole idea of like doing a double degree, especially one that's so new, how did it feel stressful, or how did you feel uncertain about doing such a different combination of subjects?
I definitely didn't feel uncertain. I was very confident in what I wanted to do. And I had the dean of the music faculty constantly saying to me, "We've had people try this before, Mary. People have tried before. They never managed to do it both. You'll pick one or the other. You'll pick one or the other." And so that just made me more determined as a good Macrob girl. So, well, you say I can't do it, I'm going to show you that I can. And so I was very determined to finish both the courses, but I was a bit of an island in the university. There was a couple of other students who by the time I was in third year, I think we got it officially made into a double degree course. And so my academic transcript actually says that I withdrew from the Bachelor of Music and I withdrew from the Bachelor of Laws and then enrolled in the Bachelor of Music and Bachelor of Laws together. But we did get there. But honestly, you know, I was one of the last years before the Melbourne model came in too. So the Melbourne model came in the mid-2000s, just as I was leaving. So all that work we'd done to get this great program up and running pretty much just went by the wayside because law became a postgraduate course in those mid-2000s.
Yeah, so was it this like motivation that people told you can't do it that you decided?
Absolutely.
To that?
Yeah, and I think that's 100% what Macrob is about, and that's what it embodied for me as a student was you can do hard things, you can do things that, you know, you think that you can't do. You will do so many things. And we'd have assembly every Monday morning. New principal came when I was in term 3 of year 9, and she would say, stand up every week at assembly and tell us, girls, you'll change career 5 to 7 times in your lives. And we'd all be like sitting there rolling our eyes going, no, we're not. We won't change our career 5 to 7 times. We'll have one career. We're all going to be lawyers and we're all going to be doctors and it's all going to be fine, right? But I think it was quite true, and I think it gave us that continual reinforcement, gave us the opportunity to reflect and realise that you could do more with life if you wanted to do so.
Yeah, so many people find it challenging to balance demanding careers with personal interests. So what do you enjoy most about learning and performing music? And have you managed to successfully combine a career in law with high-level musical performance, and what role has it played in your life?
That's a lot of questions. I'll try and remember them all. But I suppose the first thing to say is since COVID, I haven't played so much of my flute. And I have 4 young children, and it really was the 4 kids being in the house full time that got the, you know, capacity to practice was really reduced. And the 4th was a newborn baby at that point. It's her 4th birthday today.
Oh.
So that has sort of been a bit of a pause with music for a while. But up until that time, absolutely, I was combining them, I think, as best as I could do. You know, when I was working as an article clerk and I think I was also a first year lawyer, like I was still playing music at a high level, and I, you know, I was entering competitions. I was still doing well. Even at that point in my career, I would go overseas I would use my annual leave to go and study, you know, music take a summer course in somewhere, Germany, Scotland, France, something like that. You know, a really good opportunity just to make sure that I developed those skills. And my flute teacher said to me, my flute teacher was an Adelaide High girl who remembered coming to Macrob on her exchanges back in the, you know, 1960s probably. That'd be about right. Lost my train of thought. What was I talking about? Macrob.
Adelaide.
No, back flute. Oh, travel. So, yeah. So she said to me, when I got to the point where I had stopped worrying about trying to get a job as a professional musician, I really became a much more beautiful musician. And it was really nice to not have the pressure to succeed at that come to me after a really intense period, because university, again, another sort of experience where we sat down at the beginning of the course and the dean stood before us all in the Melbourne Hall and said, only 5% of you'll get a job. Which was really encouraging first week messaging to be giving to students. But it really did. It put the pressure on. But, again, like a good Macrob girl that I was, that just made me more determined to want to achieve that, right? But you realise pretty quickly as a professional flute player in this country, at that time there were 28 full-time jobs and they turn over once every 30 years. So it was really going to be as much a matter of being in the right place at the right time as it was about any of your ability. So. Yeah, being a lawyer, at least there's a need for more than 28 lawyers in this country.
So you mentioned you have 4 kids, right? So do they kind of share the same passions as you, or have they learned something from your journey as well?
I don't know if they have yet. They're not old enough probably. So I've got 10, 8, 5 and just turning 4 today. So I don't know. They see that they have parents who are driven, who are working very hard, who, you know, we both work full-time and have extra interests on top of and have a big family, right? So I suppose I would like to think that we impart something positive to them about, I mean, the role of women in the workplace, the role of, you know, a lot of where I live, we do have quite a number of mothers who work part-time or who don't work at all, who've made that choice, you know, to concentrate on the family for those early years. And I haven't made that choice because I don't think I could. And sometimes it's difficult when I, you know, Mum, why don't you pick me up every day? Why does blah, 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 Mum always does this or they always do that? And I say, well, I still contributed back as much as I can. I'm president of my son's school council. I try my very best to juggle everything that I can every day, but yeah, it's definitely a juggle. And I find a lot of adults who are from a family of four are very happy having only two kids.
Yeah, I think like as a woman who's of course navigated professional arenas, including law and music and all of your other pursuits, what insights do you have on fostering diversity and inclusion in these fields?
So important. It is so important to have a really big range of people in your organisations, right? So I'm a member at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. We're about to be disbanded and formed into a new tribunal at some point this year. I don't know if I'll be part of that organisation or not. I'm waiting to find that out. But what I can say to you is I sadly represent real diversity in that workplace. So, and in the membership of a tribunal, you're looking at a lot of people who are senior in their careers, or, you know, going towards the end of their career, might be looking at that role as a step back. There's very few of us young women there taking this as a sort of a step up in our career. So, it's been interesting to navigate the challenges of maternity leave in an organization where most people, you know, are grandparents or becoming grandparents soon, or kids have finished school. I've had to negotiate that. I've had to negotiate, you know, some of the pushback that you get for being a working mother. Sometimes if it's not your day in the office, if you're working from home, people will say, oh, don't dial you into the meeting. She's busy with her kids, which is not true, obviously. Like if you're working, you're paid to work and you do work the hours that you're paid to work. So I think it is really important to have a much if we are people at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal making decisions affecting the lives of all citizens and aspiring citizens and residents, that we reflect the people who are coming before us.
Do you have any advice for women and young women in particular who want to enter these sort of male-dominated fields? Anything you want to tell them?
You can do it. You can definitely do it, and you should just do it. You know, we are representing way more than half the university populations now. We're representing more than half of the graduates coming into law firms. What we need to do is stick at it and believe that we can stick at it. And you just have to be tough and go through the put up with sometimes that pushback that you might get from people about your choices. We can't help the fact that biologically we have to birth children and nourish children at a young age. We can't do anything about that. So we have to embrace who we are, accept who we are, and not let it stop us from being who we've always aspired to be. So I, as a McRobb girl, never, ever, ever thought I'd have children, ever. I thought, no way, I'm just going to have a career. The idea of, you know, even morning sickness, the idea of morning sickness horrified me so much that I never wanted to have kids. And then you hit a point in life when you suddenly do. But I think having that focus on what I can do and what I can achieve and what I can contribute to this world keeps you going, keeps you able to push that back as far hard as you can.
Yeah, that's really lovely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Be Like Her Live on MacRob Live, live from the McRobertson Girls High School in Melbourne, Australia. My name is Pia and my co-hosts today are Amna and Shreya, and our special guest today is member of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, Mary Sheargold.
Yeah, how did you think McRobb empowered you as a young woman, and how big of a role do you think it played?
Pivotal. It's an absolutely pivotal role that this school played in empowering. I feel that the only place that I was ever empowered as a young person was in this school. And sorry, I take that back. My parents as well did empower. Like my dad was very, very encouraging. And, you know, you will get the best education. You're capable of achieving things and you will achieve things. And this school was very much like that. The ethos that the teachers would impart onto all of us was very much, you can do, you will do. So I definitely left this place empowered. We had the very old VCE system where we used to do assignments, right? So we got to take our assignments home, write them, hand them in. There was very, very little. You'd hand one draft to a teacher, they'd give you one round of feedback, and that would be it. And then you'd have to finish it up yourself. at every other school, the teachers would take, you know, 5, 6, whatever drafts. And we would say, it's not fair. You know, even at Melbourne High, they're getting extra help. Why are they getting, why don't we get anything? And they said to, teachers would say to us, you'll thank us when you get to university. And they were right, because when we got to university, we could actually cope. We were actually fully empowered to be strong students, leading students from the very beginning. We had the lowest rate of people changing university courses of any school because of the way in which we were brought up to be in the potency, being master of yourself here. That was so important.
Yeah, and I think because of all of that, you consider yourself as someone who doesn't sit still and doesn't stand, right? So what, like, out of all the activities that you do, which ones do you think cause you to relax a little bit, or like find, I guess, a little bit more, I guess, relaxing time?
Don't, not good at that. That's a work in progress. That's actually a 2024 goal for me, is to learn to stop and breathe a bit more and enjoy life a bit more and just take a step back, because I have been running at an insane pace for quite a number of years now, and I really do need to level myself a little bit, right? So I said I'd sort of put music to a side because it was hard to get practicing done, but, you know, instead of doing music, I now teach group fitness classes. So that takes up a lot of my spare time as well. So in 2022, you know, 40 years old, I said, no, I can do this. I can be a group fitness instructor. Of course I can. And I, you know, marched in there, learned how to teach a Les Mills program, and that's what I do. And I suppose, if anything, my most still and quiet times are when I'm driving in the car on my own, which is a pretty accurate reflection on my desire to live my life to the fullest and achieve as much as I can and do as many things as I can, meaning that that time for introspection and peace and stillness really is then.
Yeah. Absolutely. You've mentioned the group fitness and driving for peace. Do you think that they help you center yourself and center yourself for your career and your job and help you in that aspect of your life?
Oh, 100%, 100%. Your health and your fitness are so, so, so important to your survival and your capacity to do really well at everything in life. And again, I mean, that's something I didn't learn at McRobb, to be honest. We had a condemned gym that was knocked down when I was in year 10, and we didn't even really do PE after that, right? And it wasn't the school's fault. It wasn't anybody's fault. It was just a circumstance. And exercise and health and well-being in that sense wasn't so valued in the 90s as we value it now. I think it's absolutely critical for all students from right now onwards to focus on making sure that you keep yourselves as strong and as fit and as healthy as you can, because that's going to help you be the best you're going to be in the career that you choose.
So you mentioned that health and fitness was quite differently viewed back in the day to now. Do you think that it's still regard, like, is there importance in the workplace in health and fitness now or no?
Some places, yes. Where I work, we have yoga and Pilates classes available at lunchtime. You can pay to go and do extra things like that, which I think is a really awesome initiative. You know, there's always a structured, you know, corporate triathlons and things like that, but often I think that's a bit more showboating than it is to actually really emphasize people's health and fitness. I think it's something that belongs to you and that you have to take ownership of. It's your own body, it's your own life, it's your own chance to give whatever you can give to yourself. You know, I started lifting weights in the gym maybe 15 years ago, and women didn't really lift weights 15 years ago. We did have an exceptional weightlifter at school when I was here, but with the exception of her. You know, it wasn't a big thing that happened, and now you go into the gym and you see all young girls lifting heavy weight, and it's really awesome to see that people are starting to realize and respect how important that is. And I think COVID probably played a role in that, you know, being stuck at home, unable to live the regular life that you had for so long, to think, what can I do to better myself? And exercise is definitely something.
Yeah. So did you face like any criticism or like some sort of backlash during that time, since people didn't used to, I guess, do all of the activities at that time?
As in the gym?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, no, it wasn't criticism, but more people would stare, and, you know, it was uncomfortable, often an uncomfortable place for women to be in a gym. You know, just like the law, just like medicine, a really male dominated area. But I think it has shifted now. But yes, it was definitely uncomfortable. Mm. But again, coming back to being, I've always been a McRobb girl who hasn't been afraid to be me and do what's right for me. And I've never been afraid to stand up to men and always regarded myself as absolutely equal. I've never thought of women as being anything less.
Yeah, I think that's really amazing. The fact that you can have such a strong mindset to overcome sort of these preconceived notions of gender and how it impacts careers and life. Do you think there are some Any apparent differences in how we view gender equality and those sorts of inequalities from your macro updates to currently?
Oh, hugely, hugely. I feel, you know, I've had moments in the last 10 years as a mother where I have just said, you know, those feminists did us such a real disservice in the end, right? Because we got to a point where we started to believe you really could have it all. And our former Governor General, Quentin Bryce, was famously quoted as saying, women can have it all, but not all at once. And I sadly think that is probably still a bit true. Like I said earlier, we can't do anything about the biological fact that if we're to procreate, it's going to fall on our bodies to do that work, right? We can't do anything about that. When I was a student, when I was a young child, it was when most mothers were still at home. If mothers were working, they were working full-time and working like full-on, you know, just as our fathers were working. They were working in exactly the same mode, and that meant a lot more paid help that they had in their homes then. You find now, but, you know, 30, 40 years later, we're judged, or we feel judged for having paid help. Why don't you get to school pick up every day? Don't you care about your children? Did you cook all that food yourself? Did you make your kids lunch today? People were getting shamed for making their kids lunch the night before. How could you send your child to school with a stale sandwich? You know, that wouldn't have happened to my mother. My mother didn't do a quarter of the things in her life, day-to-day life, that I'm probably trying to squeeze into my life, and nobody ever criticised her choices. But our choices are criticised constantly. So, yeah, there's a big shift, I think, in that generation.
Yeah, just a shift of topic. So elaborating on your passion for music, you were the president of the Victorian Flute Guide. So how do you think leadership kind of shapes your musical journey?
It's really important. I think that leadership is important for every facet of your life, and for taking control of your own life and your own destiny, you need to be a leader, right? But with a lot of these community organisations, it takes somebody with real passion and drive and commitment and willingness to step up and do those hard things, right? There's not very many people who are willing to volunteer anymore. Not many people in my generation volunteer. I'm not sure what it's going to be like for your generation, but I hope that you do a bit of an about face from what my generation has done, and you take on what you learn in this school and take that out into your lives and think, what part of the community can I give back to? So the Flute Guild gave me great opportunities. I first became exposed to that organisation as a student here. My little flute trio here, and we entered a competition that the Flute Guild ran. It wasn't a positive engagement with that organisation at that point, but over years and time, again, you know, as you aspire to being a higher level performer, you've got to get more involved with who's around you. And when I was finishing university, I did an honours thesis on the founder of the Victorian Flute Guild, and that's probably how I really came into the friendship and the inclusion in that organisation in a big way.
What do you think has been like maybe the most challenging moment or experience for you in that role, and what did you take away from it?
It was always challenges, right? So we used to run some events. I ended up losing a really big sponsor for something we made a mistake on forgetting to place an ad. I think we forgot to place an ad in a magazine that we'd, you know, said we would do. And yeah, having to deal with somebody really just having a tantrum at you, grown adults, getting really upset by things. It's difficult, but you have to work through those difficulties. We had other examples where, you know, certain committee members may have felt maligned at certain times, and you had to be able to work our way to draw people back in and realise that we are here to serve this community over here. This isn't about me. It's not about you. This is about here.
Wow. So in terms of your other like academic endeavours, you won the Freehills Prize for your paper on Indigenous cultural property rights. Could you explain a bit more about this endeavour and why it was so important?
That was a summer subject that I did, gosh, nearly 20 years ago. I feel so old when I say that. So I did a wonderful summer subject on intellectual property when I was at university. And again, that's where, you know, music and law really come together to me naturally. Copyright law, that makes a lot of sense, right? So I decided to take a look at Indigenous cultural property and the concept of, you know, collective ownership, and how can that fit in with a Western ideal of copyright, which is very much, you know, a single owner. And so I did a paper looking at the didgeridoo and how you might explore, you know, maintaining authenticity of that, maintaining integrity with that, and giving a real exploration and understanding of why or who that belongs to, really. So does the didgeridoo belong to all Indigenous Australians? No, it doesn't. What is appropriate to do with a didgeridoo? Who is allowed to play it? Why? And exploring all of those things and putting it against the societal norms that we see, the disconnect between them, and also trying to then think through how do you make sure that the people that own that cultural property are protected? It's really difficult, and it still hasn't been solved all these 20 years later.
Yeah, and then in 2013 you did another thesis, which was about. But do you want to talk a bit more about that as well?
Oh, totally. That was so much fun. I'm a flute player, right? So the kookaburra sits on the old gum tree. Men at Work's down under. Big court case that really got my attention really early on, being passionate about copyright law and being a flute player with this little flute riff in that piece of music. So to finish up my master's degree, I did decide to do a research paper, and my research paper was examining the way the court had handled its decision-making processes and, you know, looking at how people might be able to fairly use examples from previous works in new works. So copyright, you know, very much centered around literary works, so writing. I don't think it lines up so well with music. If you look at the history of music, music is all borrowing. Everything is written from borrowing from yourself, borrowing from others, and it's building on that basis that you have. So for me, the idea that you could be sued, particularly by somebody who had bought the rights to a piece of music after the composer had died, literally bought the rights, they were then able to sue another organisation for an improvised little riff that, you know, apparently people only worked out was that song when it turned up as a question on Spicks and Specs in 2007 or something. I'd always thought that's what it was. I always thought it was obvious that that's what it was, but maybe that's just the flute player in me. Looking at and the huge impact that it had, you know, the flute player who played that riff ended up passing away very shortly after the court case resolved. I mean, the you know, and was there a contribution to that demise from the extreme stress that came on all of those band members from having to go through and justify their music before a non-understanding court of law? And, you know, yeah, to receive a harsh judgment because the letter of the law said this is how it should be, and culture, I don't think, agrees with that.
That's super interesting. So do you think that this is like one of that prime example where you can combine law and music for good?
Absolutely. Yeah, I absolutely do. And I would look, you know, it was originally, that was always what I thought. If I was going to practice in law, that's what I'd end up doing. Life doesn't always work out the way you plan though, right? And so I just never actually got my foot in the door doing that in practice. But I think I've also seen that if I was to have a real passion for copyright law as it impacts music, the best way to explore and experience that is through the academic side, not through the practical side, because writing somebody a contract about, you know, how to use this song or whatever, and that's just really boring and paper pushing and, you know, passing money over. Actually diving down into how does this work, why does it work, how can we challenge this, should we do better, that's fascinating to me. So when I go back and do my PhD, it'll be on that.
Do you think copyright law or like whatever law you do in general, in addition to that, do you think that has like changed over the years, especially with the internet growing and becoming this really big phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, copyright is really a reactive area of law, so it's always behind. Sadly, it's always behind the technology. So, you know, when I was a student, we had this thing called Napster and where people could go and, you know, illegally download music, and it was so controversial at the time. The record companies were up in arms that somebody could get music from the internet. And now, do you guys know what a compact disc is?
Not quite,
yeah. Right? And that's, you know, that's only 20 years of change. You see like a massive turnaround in how we consume music, how we use it, and how we access everything. So with everything being available online, you know, that's why we have this birth of subscription service, right? The only way you get the premium content, you have to make a reason for it to be good. You have to make a reason for people to pay for content now. Otherwise, it's all just there for us to grab.
Does that mean you had to learn a lot in addition to like after graduating, you had to keep learning?
Oh, you always have to keep learning, yeah. And I think it's absolutely natural that you'll always keep learning. And I think if you stop learning, you know, that's when you've stopped living, right? So you always have to be open to new things. Lawyers have an obligation to keep up their professional learning, you know, every single year of practice. But, yeah, absolutely, you have to. You have to stay engaged. You have to read the new cases. You have to understand. You have to be front, you know, cutting edge for your clients to get the best out of you too.
Yeah, I think that's really lovely. So recently you were inducted into the Macrob Portrait Gallery in 2017. What were your emotions and feelings, and how did it feel to be recognized as one of those incredible, successful women in their field?
Look, it's a really, I think that was a really, truly humbling experience. My sister was one of the people at the original inductees to the Portrait Gallery. Okay. And I never thought that I would be, you know, able to achieve the levels of, not notoriety is not the right word, but I didn't think that I really did that much that was special or different from what other Macrob girls around me were doing. But, you know, it was very lovely that two separate people decided at the same time to put an application in on my behalf. And, yeah, you definitely felt that humbling experience. And I remember my sister was living overseas at the time that induction was on, but my dad came along and I never saw him so pleased as he was to have both of his daughters, portraits hanging up in the hallway, and they actually end up putting us almost opposite each other as if we were having a conversation, and he just thought that was the best thing. But for me, being recognised on that wall is never going to be as much for me as what this school was able to do to change my life, right? So I will always owe to this school and this community much more than I can ever repay.
Yeah, and you're a part of the Macrob Foundation as well. So do you think that it plays a huge role in doing that same, I guess, promoting the empowerment?
Absolutely, yeah. And that was 100% what we were driven to when we decided to go ahead. That was about 10 years ago now that we all started that up. Tony Meath was a principal at that time, and I actually rang the school one day. I was going to do a will. I said, I want to leave my flute to the school. I want some poor student to have the benefit of my flute. I don't know what I was thinking. And they said, oh, well, that's very interesting you say this. We've actually got this thing with, you know, we're trying to work out how we can do something like that. And I said, oh, who's the lawyer helping you with the paperwork for it? And they said, oh, we haven't got one. I said, well, you know, just call me if you, I'll see what I can do. And yeah, that was the beginning of how my involvement with the Macrob Foundation, totally by serendipity, I suppose. But it was, yeah, again, really nice. And I spent a lot of time when I was involved with the foundation, a lot of time here every month or so, and being able to engage with students, being able to think, what can we do to better the lives of students here? Because we are bright women. We are intelligent young women, but we don't always have the same opportunity and advantage that when you get to university and you find yourself aligned with perhaps, you know, ATAR peers, they may not be your peers in a lot of other senses. And it was really confronting for me to realize just how hard it is to make it on your own. And so I think it's really important for us as Macrob, despite our potent sui motto, we actually have to work together and help each other and stay together and nurture the Macrob girls that come after us in their careers. When we're at the top, we bring people up with us. We need to do much more of that as a school.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming here and talking with us today. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for. But yes, thank you so much again to member of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, Mary Sheargold. It has been a great pleasure. This is live from the McRobertson Girls High School in Melbourne, Australia. You have been listening to Be Like Her Live on Macrob Live. Once again, I am the host, Pia, and today my co-hosts were Amna and Shreya. And thank you for joining us. We hope you have found this information useful. And until next time, have a great day.
Celebrating female role models across our community, live from the McRobertson Girls High School in Melbourne, Australia, you're listening to Be Like Her Live on Macrob Live.